we're going to be cautiously optimistic, but we feel like things are moving in the right direction.
Korean leaders prepare for historic meeting. It's Monday, April 2nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook right now at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China's space station leaves orbit. Peking University opens in the UK. Yellow-spotted frogs return to Australia. A tough road for New York immigrant taxi drivers. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The leaders of North and South Korea are scheduled to meet for a summit April 27th at the South's Peace House in the Truce Village of Panmunjom, the first meeting of its kind since 2007 and only the third since the 1953 armistice that ended the fighting in the Korean War. The announcement Thursday followed a surprise unofficial visit to Beijing by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, his first foreign travel since assuming power in 2011. Mr. Xi briefed President Donald Trump about the talks in which Mr. Kim pledged to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. On Wednesday, Mr. Trump tweeted he thought there was a good chance the North Korean leader would do what is right for his people and for humanity. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders suggested things are going in the right direction.
We're going to be cautiously optimistic, but we feel like things are moving in the right direction and that the meeting yesterday was a good indication that the maximum pressure campaign has been working. And we're going to continue moving forward in this process and hopes for a meeting down the road.
That meeting would be between Mr. Trump and Kim Jong-un. But despite growing hope for denuclearization, satellite imagery in recent weeks has revealed continuing activity at the North Yongbyung Nuclear Research Center. Allison Puccioni, a consultant and affiliate with the Stanford University Center for International Security and Cooperation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the North continues to produce weapons-grade plutonium.
There is no doubt that North Korea has been operating their 5-megawatt reactor for quite some time, intermittently. And we know that the 5-megawatt reactor has been operational. We also know that it has been operating for weapons-grade plutonium. This has been the agenda, you know, for North Korea to build nuclear weapons-grade material for their arsenal. It has been happening for quite some time. This isn't necessarily new activity at the 5-megawatt reactor.
Is this malign activity? Is it directed toward nuclear weapons, or is it simply for electrical needs?
The 5-megawatt reactor is not purposed for creating electricity. The 5-megawatt reactor is purposed for creating weapons-grade plutonium.
There are some various reports that indicate increasing activity or decreasing activity. What is your view?
The 5-megawatt reactor has been intermittently active for years. So this is not increasing or decreasing. It's my opinion that it's the same amount of activity that we've seen throughout 2017. And frankly, since the 5-megawatt reactor was more or less restarted for weapons production in 2013.
So as far as you know, the nuclear program continues relatively apace as it has in the past.
The 5-megawatt reactor is purposed for weapons-grade plutonium production, and that activity has continued apace. The second reactor, the one that North Korea broke ground construction on in 2010, has been under construction and inactive since 2010. So that is the experimental light water reactor. That reactor has been, at least ostensibly, purposed for electricity production.
RAND Corporation senior international defense researcher Bruce Bennett said there is a view that Kim Jong-un will use his nuclear program as a bargaining tool to extract concessions from South Korea and the U.S.
I've talked with a number of very senior defectors who argue that in 1990, Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, was taking over responsibility for the nuclear program, and he ordered that action be taken to disclose Yongbyon to the Americans, but on the other hand, that five different alternative sites be set up to support the nuclear program, hoping that the Americans would focus in on Yongbyon and not pay attention to these other locations, which they could then operate covertly. I suspect that his son may be doing something similar right now. I think he's preparing for the summits, hoping to divert our attention, hoping to add new capabilities, and be able to sustain them because they're covert, even after he's making the initial parts of an agreement, that we just don't ask for them to shut down location X or location Y, and so he continues operating them even after an agreement.
Verification is going to be very difficult under any agreement, won't it?
The key there is we've got to be able to have challenge inspections, and to go with that, we have to know where to look. We've got to be trying to get defectors from North Korea, from people out of the nuclear program who we encourage to leave North Korea and provide us at least cues on where to go look to find these things and then pursue challenge inspections.
Bruce Bennett said the White House correctly remains cautious about a breakthrough on the nuclear issue, insisting on keeping up the maximum pressure campaign. He said key to that will be China and what President Xi Jinping may have promised the North Korean leader. Meanwhile, Japan is reportedly in talks with North Korea about another bilateral summit. Tokyo said it is in touch with Pyongyang but declined to provide specifics. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and also the voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. United States and South Korea begin annual joint military exercises. 18 killed in violent clashes in Indian Kashmir. Tibetans mark 60th year of Dalai Lama's arrival in India. Chinese space station expected to crash anytime. K-pop diplomacy. South Koreans fly to Pyongyang for rare concerts. Expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Space scientists keeping track of a dysfunctional space equipment are also closely monitoring the expected reentry of the largest piece of space junk in history. As we speak, the Chinese space station Tiangong 1 is rapidly descending toward Earth's atmosphere. Experts say it will be traveling so fast that the resulting friction will cause it to disintegrate and burn. But as VOA's George Pudich reports, small pieces may still reach the Earth.
China's first space lab, Tiangong 1, or Heavenly Palace 1, was launched in 2011 as a facility for testing docking capabilities with other Chinese spacecraft and to explore the possibilities for building a larger, permanent space station by 2023. Chinese astronauts visited it several times, flying aboard the Shenzhou spacecraft. It was scheduled for a controlled deorbit and eventual crash into the Pacific Ocean, but in September 2016, China's space agency conceded it had lost contact with the station. The head of the European Space Agency's Space Debris Office, Holger Craig, says the 8.5-ton craft will re-enter the atmosphere at a speed of 27,000 kilometers per hour.
It is basically the upper atmosphere and the atmosphere density that will produce a drag that will eventually bring down the station. And that drag is very, very hard to understand and to predict because the atmosphere and that altitude, 200 kilometers, that's where the station is at the moment, is extremely hard to describe in a physical way, and that's causing the difficulty.
Craig says the spacecraft will burn out somewhere between the 43rd northern and southern parallels, but he says uncontrolled re-entries happen all the time.
The risk, though, on ground is still very low. There have been 13,000 tons of space hardware coming down in the whole history of spaceflight, and there's no single reported casualty.
The re-entry area covers huge parts of the Earth's oceans, so any surviving pieces of the old space station are most likely to end up at the bottom of the sea. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, 18 people have been killed in three separate incidents Sunday as Indian troops conducted counterinsurgency operations in Indian Kashmir. The Indian soldiers and militants died in clashes south of Srinagar, the main city of the region divided between India and Pakistan, but claimed in full by both. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's Monday morning. We're glad you're starting your week off with us here at VOA Asia. China's leading Peking University recently opened a UK campus in Oxford, which became part of its HSBC Business School. While there is an increasing number of Western universities opening campuses in China in the recent years, Peking University is not the first to open a campus abroad, but it is the first to be offering diploma-granting programs in the West. A Chinese embassy official in London said the campus opening pays tribute to the China-UK Golden Age. Such speech signals that Beijing views this venture as a cornerstone to project its soft power. VOA Asia intern Harry Chen spoke with Jia Qiang, associate professor in international education at York University in Toronto. Harry asked what the incentives are for Chinese universities to go abroad.
Unlike NYU, Shijiazhuang Liupu, even though those offshore campuses, they do showcase the academic excellence, the primary motive behind the approach is to get the economic profits. But the PKU approach is different. I don't think they aim to make money with this approach. I strongly believe they just want to show the presence of the Chinese university. So in that sense, it's more political than academic, than economic. It's not necessarily negative. Even though at the present stage it's political, the Chinese universities, unlike their counterparts in the Western societies, the Western universities tend to be autonomous. They want to keep a distance from the government. But this is not the case for Chinese universities. They want to be close to the government, and they want to be part of the government agenda for promoting the national interest. So in that sense, I think the PKU approach is quite political. It's to showcase, you know, with rise of Chinese economic power and Chinese academic power, educational power is also on the rise.
The Chinese media said the inauguration of the new campus marked the first time the Chinese university has opened an overseas campus through private funding and under independent management. How big a watershed moment is this opening in the Chinese higher education history?
It is significant by all means. This might be the first one that a top Chinese university offering the offshore campus in the location which is very significant. If you think about the Peking University, a new offshore campus in Oxford, in the proximity to such a world-class Oxford University. So I guess in that sense, it is significant.
Confucius centers and classrooms which the Chinese government uses vehicles to teach Chinese languages and culture have come under increased scrutiny for censoring certain views. And do you think Peking University and those who may follow suit will get a similar flag too?
It really depends on how you practice that. I know the Confucius Institute is suffering from some backlashes. People are constantly accusing the Confucius Institute as a move behind an expansion of China's national interest. In a broad sense, this kind of internationalization is part of the educational interventions in the global or international arena. To overcome those kind of the arguments, you need to move forward and reach the stage to have international education for the global public good. We're not there yet. This is still a notion, but a goal. We're working towards that. We are far away from a global civil society, but without steps like this, there's no way forever to reach the global society.
Jia Qiang, associate professor in international education at York University, speaking with VOA Asia intern Harry Chen. Peking University said the school will offer programs like economy and financial management, and the recruitment for its first class on the Oxford campus has almost concluded. Coming up, new life for a presumed extinct frog. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and his wife attended a concert of South Korean K-pop singers performing at a rare event in Pyongyang Sunday. It was the first time in more than a decade that South Korean musicians have traveled to the North as relations between the two nations thaw. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Sydney's Taronga Zoo has released a specially bred group of critically endangered yellow-spotted bell frogs into the wild. Yellow-spotted bell frogs were thought to have become extinct. Phil Mercer in Sydney tells us a chance discovery about a decade ago allowed scientists to breed a so-called insurance population in captivity to help the species recover.
Historically, yellow-spotted bell frogs were found in two separate highland ranges in the north and south of New South Wales state in eastern Australia. But disaster struck in the 1970s following an outbreak of an infectious disease that affects amphibians around the world. For 30 years, there were no recorded sightings of yellow-spotted bell frogs, and scientists thought they were extinct. However, a small group of these rare frogs was found near the New South Wales town of Yass in 2009 on the southern tablelands. Researchers moved quickly to harvest eggs, and they became part of a so-called insurance population. It has been a success. This week, experts from Taronga Zoo in Sydney released 200 juvenile frogs back into the area near Yass in an attempt to re-establish a wild population. Michael McFadden is a supervisor at the zoo.
In the northern and southern tablelands, this species used to be extremely common up until the late 1970s. And at that time, the species almost went extinct over a couple of years. So it disappeared. It was thought to have gone extinct. The reason for that decline was due to the introduction of an introduced pathogen called chytrid fungus. Unfortunately for this species, they showed very little immunity. And as a result, they were wiped out over a period of 1 or 2 years.
Insurance populations of endangered Tasmanian devils have also been bred in captivity in Australia. In the wild, the world's largest surviving carnivorous marsupial has been devastated by a contagious facial cancer that was first recognised in the 1990s. A small number of animals bred in captivity have been released into the wild, fueling hopes this iconic species can recover. There are hopes, too, the yellow-spotted bell frogs can do the same. Chytrid fungus causes chytridiomycosis, which has been described by scientists as one of the most devastating wildlife diseases ever known. It's devastated frog populations in Australia, Africa, Asia, the Americas, and Europe. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news alert from VOA Asia, China's Tiangong-1 space station, about the size of a school bus, is coming to Earth in a fiery blaze. The re-entry area covers huge parts of the Earth's oceans, so any surviving pieces of the space station are most likely to end up at the bottom of the sea, posing only a slight threat to people on the ground. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a financially distraught yellow cab driver from Romania recently hanged himself in his New York garage, marking the fourth incident of suicide among city taxi drivers in as many months. In the tragedy's aftermath, members of New York's Taxi Cab Drivers Union are renewing their calls for a cap on the number of app-based-for-hire vehicles, such as Uber and Lyft. VOA's Ramon Taylor tells us the newer services are driving workers of a once-thriving industry into the ground.
Put them $20,000 a year like I have to pay my mortgage!
The financial hardship that led to the suicide of a 65-year-old Romanian immigrant and your 30-year veteran of New York's yellow cab industry is becoming a familiar narrative to his colleagues and close friends.
He couldn't take it! I will take it! I will die fighting! I'm not going to leave it like this! It is in my right! Because I invest in the city, and they are robbing me now.
The number of yellow cabs in New York City is capped at over 13,000. But four hire cars like Uber, which face no such limits, have burgeoned since their debut in 2012. More than 60,000 to date.
We are sick and of burying our brothers. It is a nightmare. Owner drivers are going through foreclosures and bankruptcies. Green cab drivers have been entirely abandoned. Livery drivers are trying to scrape by.
It was here in front of New York City Hall that livery driver Doug Shifter killed himself using a shotgun in February, just hours after posting a message to Facebook detailing his spiraling economic distress, including 100-plus hour work weeks, a norm among many drivers in the industry.
I didn't have enough money to pay my this month rent.
Fewer pickups mean more hours on the road. For the city's immigrant population, which accounts for more than 90% of all professional drivers, that poses a deepening crisis.
After lease and gas, you do not make nothing for yourself. So you have to work like 15, 16 hours, what you're making in before 10 hours, you know.
I'm even surprised that there are no more drivers committing suicide or going on some other sort of rampage at this time, because this business has been so destroyed.
Nigerian native Emmanuel Agbai owns a taxi medallion, a license required for all canary yellow taxicabs. It was once a prized possession costing over $1 million in 2014, but has since fallen to one-fifth that value, coinciding with the rise of app-based services. Customers have more budget-friendly choices, making the option to own or lease a taxi far less profitable.
I want to work. I'm willing to work, ready to work every day to make my living. I love driving cab. In fact, I have a lot of education, but I chose to do this job, okay? At the end of the day, if I cannot make money, my love for this job doesn't mean a thing.
Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
Taxi drivers not only face competition from services like Uber and Lyft, autonomous cars also loom on the horizon. But a recent fatality involving one of Uber's self-driving cars may have created uncertainty and doubt regarding the future of autonomous vehicles. It's not stopping automakers, who say autonomous and self-driving vehicles are here to stay. As VOA's Tina Trin reports, autonomous vehicles and electric cars were increasingly front and center at the New York International Auto Show.
Automakers at the New York International Auto Show are adopting and showing off the new technologies that are driving the future of their industry. Among the standouts, the Lincoln Aviator, a three-row sport utility vehicle that drivers can operate with their smartphone.
You can use it to do everything your key fob does today, so you can leave that key fob behind. If your phone dies or it breaks, you still have a way to get in with your personal code.
The Aviator is Lincoln's first car with a plug-in hybrid option, alternating between electric and the traditional combustion engine, a move that reflects a growing trend in the auto industry.
When you look out in about 10 or 15 years, you will see very few internal combustion engines that don't have some type of electrification.
16 automakers have joined forces to raise consumer awareness with the Drive Change, Drive Electric campaign.
There was a time where you were limited by vehicle size, but now if you want an electric car, the sky's the limit on the type of car you can get.
Jaguar is going all in with its I-PACE model, the company's first all-electric car.
This vehicle has an estimated EPA range of 240 miles. It has quick charging. On a DC charger, you can have a 80% charge from zero in about 40 minutes.
The luxury automaker is also partnering with self-driving car company Waymo.
They're going to begin testing our I-PACE this year, fitted with their equipment, and it'll be fully autonomous vehicle.
Despite the recent crash in Arizona when an Uber self-driving car struck and killed a pedestrian, autonomous vehicles are not going away.
IHS Markit forecasts that in about 2040, we'll see about 33 million autonomous vehicles sold that year. That'll be about 25% of all vehicles sold in 2040.
Others offered a bit more context in light of recent events.
These new technologies will really move everyone forward in addressing the 94% of crashes that are an effect of human behavior.
Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. As technology continues to evolve, you can hear us in many different ways. But one great way to listen to us is always on the radio. Many radio stations around Asia carry our program, like CCU Radio at National Chung-Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who is listening today. Our thanks go out to director Tracy Carter and engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman. We know her very well. as well as managing editor Diane Gao and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.